So good morning, everyone, and welcome back to this third day of our Tenants Weekend. Today we're going to be looking at the second of the four tenant schools, the Saltrantica School. But before we do that, let's start with a short meditation to prepare the body, prepare the mind, and setting a good motivation for the day. So we begin, of course, by preparing the body, keeping the back nice and straight, and allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Paying particular attention to the area of the face. And if you find it helpful, you can take three slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And preparing the mind by letting go of any thoughts of the past or the future. Simply allowing the mind to rest in the present moment, focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now allowing your eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. And now release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest, resting in awareness itself. Not trying to do anything at all, without trying to meditate, just be. Be present. Be aware. Simply be aware of being aware. Now all sorts of appearances will continue to arise, but now pay no attention to any appearance. And simply rest in the stillness of awareness. know, to help balance the mind, to help overcome any tension or distraction. Release your awareness into space in all directions, releasing all appearances and relaxing completely. Now, to help overcome dullness or being spaced out, bring your awareness right in upon itself, right into the experience of awareness itself, and focus clearly. Once again, releasing awareness into space, releasing all appearances, relaxing completely. Once again, bringing your awareness right in upon itself, right into the experience of awareness itself, focusing clearly. Now simply allow the mind to rest, resting in luminously clear awareness. Relaxed and alert. open and spacious. Now, for the last minute or so of this meditation, think about your motivation for coming here today and set the best possible motivation you can. So let's start with a short review before we move into the Sautrantika system, the explanation. So maybe we can use the four Buddhist tenet systems chart that you have there. So what we saw originally on the first day was that through the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma that the Buddha taught, the Four Noble Truths, the second turning of the wheel called Without Characteristics, and the third, Fine Discrimination. From these three turnings of the wheel, where the Buddha taught slightly different ideas, particularly in terms of the nature of reality, we have the four philosophical schools or systems slowly developing. The first of those, the Vaibhashika, was the first system to really evolve after the time of the Buddha. And we saw there that it's normally described in terms of these 18 sub-schools, that some of them have some minor differences of understanding. But this system really started to evolve in the centuries after the Buddha achieved enlightenment. Then we have the Sautrantika philosophical system, which we're going to look at today, which really started to evolve a little bit later, initially around the 4th century through great Indian master Vasubandhu. And then another sub-school of the Sautrantika really started to develop through the efforts of another great Indian master, Dharmakirti, in the 7th century. Both of those philosophical systems based on the Four Noble Truths teachings. So in those philosophical systems, then the goal of the spiritual path is liberation from samsara, is nirvana. Then within the third philosophical system, Chittamatra, is coming from the third turning the wheel, fine discrimination. And here the Buddha taught that the external world is not existing as it appears. Whereas in the Four Noble Truths, of course, the main source of error that was identified was grasping onto self of person. That actually there's not really any problem with how we see the world. There is an objective world there, but it's simply we overinflate the sense of me. We're grasping onto this self, and that's the fundamental ignorance we're suffering from. Whereas in the third and fourth philosophical system and the second and third turning the wheel, the Buddha in both of those places said that there is actually a deeper underlying mistake or distortion, and that is actually the world is not existing as it appears. In the Chittamatra philosophical system, which came out of the third turning of the wheel, the idea is that even though there seems to be an external world out there, actually, if we investigate, we'll come to realize that there is no external physical world, that the world is internal to the mind. Or in other words, mind only, which is often the English translation of the Sanskrit word Chittamatra. And in the second turning wheel, also the Buddha taught that the world, there seems to be that external independent world, but it doesn't exist as it appears. But here he said that actually the world does not exist as it appears, but also if we turn our attention to the person, there is also no independent subjective me. So there's no independent objective world, no independent subjective me. This idea of emptiness, that nothing exists from its own side. And so from that, we have the fourth philosophical system of Majjhimika being formed, particularly through the efforts of great Indian master Nagarjuna in the 2nd century. The Chittamatra system really started to develop through Asanga in the 4th century. So those two philosophical systems, of course, we're going to look at next weekend. And in those, they both talk about the idea of emptiness, that the world does not exist as it appears. But they also talk about, in those philosophical systems, the idea that actually enlightenment is actually a further goal than nirvana. Whereas in the first two philosophical systems, they don't really have that clear distinction. And so therefore, these two philosophical systems are often referred to as the Mahayana. So that's next weekend's topic. So let's just do a brief review of the Vaibhashika system, which we covered yesterday and a little bit the day before we move on to the Sautrantika. Because even though both of these come from the Four Noble Truths teachings, and so there's of course a lot of similarities in their assertions, there are some significant differences in what they assert. So to refresh our idea of the Vaibhashika assertions, we can just very briefly go through the Vaibhashika section of the text. So The first thing we see is that, of course, the Vaibhashika accepts these truly existent external objects. There is an objective world, but they do not accept this self-cognition. As we're going to see shortly, Sautrantika do accept self-cognition. And remember, self-cognition is a way of, for some of the philosophical systems, a way of explaining how we know that we perceive things. So we have a valid cognizer which validly knows objects, but how do we know that our consciousness itself at the time of knowing the object? And so some of the philosophical systems posit this idea of self-cognizer for that. And we'll look at that in more detail very shortly, because this is one of the Sautrantika assertions. And here we saw that the Vaibhashika in this text is divided into these three groups, regional, but more commonly we see this classification into 18 sub-schools. And in the etymology, the word Vaibhashika, Vaibhasa, means particular. And one of the etymologies of the word Vaibhashika is that the Vaibhashikas have this very unique assertion about the three times, past, present, future, that none of the other philosophical systems have. They assert that the three times are instances or particulars of substances. And we saw that a little bit, that sort of a bit peculiar way of looking at the three times day before yesterday. And also then in terms of the fourth outline, the way of asserting objects, the Vaibhashikas also have a unique assertion in terms of things, functioning things. Things are, of course, able to form a function. And it's only the Vaibhashikas that assert that permanent phenomena are actually able to perform a function. Whereas all the other philosophical systems have the two types of phenomena. There's impermanent phenomena, which can perform a function, and permanent phenomena, unchanging phenomena, that cannot perform a function. So this is one of the differences for Vaibhashika between that and all the other schools. And then we looked at the two truths. And both in Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, the two truths are actually two types or two classes of phenomena. Whereas as we're going to see next weekend in Chittamatta and Majjhimika, when we talk about two truths, ultimate truth is how things exist, and conventional truth are the things that exist. So there's a little bit different idea about what we mean by the two truths there. And here for Vaibhashika, the division into conventional truth and ultimate truth is ultimate truth is basically is seen to be what are the fundamental building blocks of the universe. And so they talk about this partless particles and direction and temporally partless moments of consciousness as the foundation for the physical and mental world. So they are the ultimate truth. And then everything that is comes out of that aggregation of either physical particles or moments of consciousness, of course, is conventional truth. So this is how they talk about ultimate and conventional truth. And then when we look at the object possessors, the subjects, the first one we talked about person. And so we went into quite an extensive presentation about what is the illustration of the person. And we saw there that in all of the Buddhist schools, plus in any philosophical system that talks particularly about life after life, has to really posit what is the continuity, what is it that goes from life to life. And also within Buddhism, because they talk about the idea of karma, what is it that sort of carries this karmic seeds? So they talk about what is this continuity, and they all talk about this idea of person. And there's various different assertions about what the person is. But all schools, apart from the Prasangika school, point to something as the illustration of the person. Whereas the Prasangika system, because they assert nothing exists inherently, talk about the mere I. And we'll look in Prasangika next weekend what we mean by the mere I as the illustration of the person. And then we also talked about valid cognition and so forth briefly. And another sort of a little bit peculiar assertion of the Vaibhashika that no other philosophical system has
is that they also consider a sense faculty as a valid perception, valid sense perception, whereas, of course, no other school would assert that. And then when we looked at the way of asserting selflessness, we saw that actually not only in Vaibhashika, but in all philosophical systems below the Prasangika, they all talk about, in terms of selflessness of person, they talk about these two coarse and subtle selflessness. That all Buddhist philosophical systems, of course, refute the idea of a unitary, unchanging, independent self that some of the non-Buddhist systems were asserting as the person at the time of the Buddha. But also all the philosophical systems within Buddhism also refute the idea of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. That the person, or that there is a self that's something more than merely the body and the mind. And we instinctively have that false sense of me, of self. And all the Buddhist philosophical systems refute that. And particularly here in Vaibhashika, but also Sautrantika and Chittamatra, they say that if we can realize there's no such self, that this is actually the fundamental ignorance. And by realizing this, we can achieve liberation from samsara. We can achieve the goal of nirvana. And of course, they do not assert a selfness as a phenomenon, because for Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, there is a truly existent world out there. And then we looked at how we progress on the spiritual path based on realizing that no self or selflessness. And there we saw this idea of the three vehicles, three types of practitioner, the Shravaka or the hearer, the solitary realizer, and the Bodhisattva. And then based on these three approaches to practice, we saw that in the Vaibhashika, they spend different amount of time accumulating merit and thereby achieve what's called either a small, middling, or great enlightenment. And we saw there that they also have a little bit different assertion in terms of when we achieve the goal of nirvana, there's this idea of nirvana without remainder. And without remainder means without the remainder of the aggregates of the body and the mind. So when we achieve the goal of nirvana, or in the case of Shakyamuni Buddha, achieved enlightenment, then during that life, after achieving nirvana enlightenment, we have what's called nirvana with remainder, with the remainder of the aggregates, the body and the mind. But then at the time of the end of this life, we enter into what's called nirvana without remainder. And within the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika philosophical system, they share the same view that at that point, the continuum of these aggregates is severed, or it's like a candle going out. And we tried to sort of understand what that meant yesterday. And I had a look at these tenets books here yesterday regarding that, if they have any more information, but they were very, very brief on that point. But maybe just to read a couple of the things that are being said in here and to see if we can understand better what they mean by that. So firstly, in this book here on page 77, it says the following. And this is just commentary by the authors here, the Western authors, who make their own interpretation of this. So what they're saying is, nirvana is neither a place, it is a fact about us. The nirvana is an absence of afflictions in someone whose cultivation of wisdom has resulted in the destruction of ignorance, desire, hatred, etc. That mere absence is the nirvana. On that, all Buddhist schools agree. However, they disagree over the use of the term remainder in conjunction with nirvana. Other than the Prasangika, so Prasangika also have a different idea of what the word with remainder and without remainder means, and we'll look at that next weekend. It is said, so all schools apart from Prasangika say, that after a person attains nirvana, he or she subsequently can be said to have a nirvana with remainder, the remainder being the body and the mind. Death cuts the remainder. However, the nirvana without remainder is a single moment, occurring just after the time of death, but not after. After death, there is no person to whom the nirvana can belong. And then also in the actual tenets texts, it talks this, about this very briefly. It says the following on page 155. And in the tenets text, it says, severing the material and mental continuum at the time of all three nirvanas without remainder is the fruit. And then there's a commentary. It says, cutting the material and mental continuum on the occasion of the three nirvanas without remainder is asserted as the fruit. And then there's a footnote here that says, nirvana with remainder is the nirvana in the continuum of a person who still has a remainder of aggregates, i.e. is still alive. A nirvana without remainder is that which occurs upon the person's death. Since there are three final vehicles of the hearer, arhat, solitary realized arhat, and Buddha, there are three types of nirvana without remainder. So again, it doesn't say very much there. And similarly, in this book here, it's very brief. It says the following. On page 232, it says the following. They assert that in all three actualizations of nirvana without remainder by hearers, solitary realizers, and Buddhas, the continuum of matter and mind are severed, whereupon only the sphere of peace remains. And then there's also something else on page 244, which says the following. And this is talking about, in particular, talking about the Buddha passing into parinirvana. It says, they assert that until a Buddha displays the deed of nirvana, that is, dies, there is a nirvana with remainder. Upon nirvana, that is, upon death, a nirvana without remainder is actualized like the death of a flame of a butter lamp. And then there's a... there's a footnote here that says the simile is a flame that goes out because of the exhaustion of its fuel. The comparison is not made to blowing out a flame. So it's just through the exhaustion of the fuel, meaning exhaustion of the causes to be reborn again. So that's all that's really said in these two texts. So maybe we have to dig a little bit deeper to try and understand more in detail what does this nirvana without remainder mean in the Vaibhashika Sautrantika school. So that's all I wanted to review on the Vaibhashika. Does anyone have any last question about Vaibhashika before we now look at Sautrantika school? Okay, let's go on to Sautrantika now. So it's on page 6 of your tenets text. And again, with the Sautrantika, as with all of these four school systems, there's the same 7 outlines. So again, starting with outline 1, the definition. So the definition of a proponent of Sautrantika is a person propounding Hinayana tenets who asserts both self-cognition and external objects. Of course, here... implied, of course, is truly existent external objects. So self-cognition we'll leave till later, because actually when we talk about valid cognition, there's a definition of what self-cognition is, and so we'll look at that a little bit later in the Sautrantika section. So the difference between Vaibhashika Sautrantika, or one difference is, of course, is Vaibhashika do not accept or assert self-cognition and Sautrantika do. And then there are, it says, proponent of Sautrantika and exemplifier are equivalent. Divisions. With Sautrantika also we have two sub-schools. the followers of Scripture and the followers of reasoning. And here it says, an example of a follower of Scripture is a proponent of Sautrantika who follows Vasubandha's Abhidharma Kosha. So, in fact, Vasubandhu, as we briefly mentioned yesterday, originally was a Vaibhashika proponent, and his Abhidharma Kosha was really based on the Vaibhashika idea. But then Vasubandhu wrote his own commentary to Abhidharma Kosha, and in his commentary he took the Sautrantika view and was a little bit critical of some of the things in the Abhidharma Kosha. But then Vasubandhu was the sort of brother or half-brother of a Sangha. They both lived in the 4th century. And a Sangha was the founder of the Chittamatra view. So then a Sangha, I think through his efforts, Vasubandhu later in his life then became Chittamatra. So yesterday we saw how he, as a Chittamatra, wrote some texts refuting Vaibhashika and Sautrantika. So he sort of moved a little bit in his understanding in his life. So the first of the sub-schools is following Vasubandhu, following this Abhidharma Kosha, particularly the auto-commentary to the Abhidharma Kosha. Whereas there's another sub-school, what's called the followers of reasoning, who is a proponent of Sautrantika who followed Dharmakirti's 7 treatises on valid cognition. So Dharmakirti, and also Dignaga prior to Dharmakirti, very famous for really developing in a very fine way, and we're going to see that later in Sautrantika, epistemology, the idea of valid cognition and how we know things and what's a valid mind and what's not a valid mind. So a lot of the assertions in Sautrantika we're going to see in terms of valid cognition and so forth are particularly coming through that sub-school of Sautrantika. And then in terms of the etymology, why are they called proponents of Sautrantika? It says, they are called proponents of Sautrantika due to propounding tenets through following the sutras of the Bhagavan. The Bhagavan, of course, the Buddha. And they are called exemplifiers, so that was another name for them we saw earlier, due to desiring to teach all phenomena by way of examples, using examples to explain things. So that's a fairly straightforward etymology. So therefore, the word Sautrantika is often translated as the sutra school because they're really following very closely the sutras of Buddha. And then if we go into the fourth outline, the way of asserting objects, we have here the definition of existent. And the definition of existent is that observed by valid cognition. Now, there are a number of terms that are synonymous with existent, and there is another text that probably a number of you have studied called Collected Topics, which is a text I think that was written about a century ago, and that is particularly based on Dharmakirti's works. And a number of the things we're going to be covering here are explained in that Collected Topics, and so I'll refer to that text a little bit to explain some of these things in more detail. And in first, here, in terms of existent, there are a number of terms that are synonymous with that. So maybe we can mention those here now. So here, again, the definition of existent is that observed by valid cognition or valid cognizer. There's a number of other terms mentioned here that are synonymous. One is established base. And that, the definition is that established by a valid cognizer, so a very similar definition. Object of knowledge is that suitable to be an object of awareness. Phenomenon, so phenomenon is
a translation of Tibetan word chir, which actually is a translation of the Sanskrit word dharma. So dharma actually has many meanings. I think I read in one text, maybe it was even Abhidharma Kosha, where there was 10 meanings of the word dharma listed. One of them, it simply means phenomena. And the definition of phenomena, and this goes back really to the actual word dharma and the etymology of the word dharma, because I think part of the word dharma, dhira, means to hold. So phenomena, the definition is that which holds its own entity. And then another synonymous word to existent here is object. An object is object realized by awareness. And another one is object of comprehension, object realized by valid cognizer. So in many of those definitions, we see that an existent is really something that is established through valid cognition. So here we see that we're starting to find that sort of parallel between valid cognition and what exists. And that's something that's really going to be amplified more in the coming section in the Sautrantikas. So this is some synonymous terms with existent. And then here there's a way of dividing up existence into conventional truths and ultimate truths. And here in Sautrantika, and this definition of conventional truth and ultimate truth coming up is something, again, coming through Dharmakirti. So it's only accepted by the sub-school of Sautrantika, the followers of reasoning. So the followers of scripture, those who are following Abhidharma Kosha, which was again based on the Vaibhashika, actually the followers of scripture, Sautrantika, have the same definition of conventional truth and ultimate truth as the Vaibhashikas. So for that subschool, the ultimate truth are the partless particles and temporally partless moments of consciousness. And conventional truth is all the things made out of those. Whereas here, the followers of reasoning, based on Dharmakirti's work, have a very different perspective of what they consider to be ultimate truth and conventional truth. Their perspective is not really what are the fundamental building blocks of the universe as being the ultimate truth. Their perspective in terms of ultimate truth is what can actually do something, you know, what's actually able to perform a function. So that's actually the definition of ultimate truth for the Sautrantikas, a phenomena that is able to perform a function ultimately. And over the page, then, we have some synonyms for ultimate truth. So here we see ultimate truth, truly existent, thing, product, impermanent phenomena, compounded phenomena, substance, and specifically characterized phenomena are equivalent. So again, here in the collected topics, they have a very similar list to this as things that are synonymous with functioning thing or ultimate truth. So truly existent, of course, means something existing. Oh, here I think truly existent and falsely existent maybe are not exactly the same meaning. Truly existent here also, again, is synonymous with any functioning thing. And thing here is functioning thing, which is the definition of that is that which is able to perform a function. The same definition we saw in Vaibhashika, of course, the difference in Vaibhashika is they accept that actually permanent phenomena can perform a function. No other school, including Sautrantika, would accept that. Product here, the definition of product is created phenomena. So a product is anything created through causes and conditions. Impermanent phenomena, the definition of impermanent phenomena is momentary phenomena, something that's changing moment by moment. Compounded phenomena or composed phenomena here is defined as disintegrating phenomena,
meaning something that also not only is created through causes and conditions, something that is momentary and then disintegrates, it does not remain.
Substance,
there's no definition of substance here in the collected topics, but I think substance here is a little bit what we talked about, substantial existent, something that does not need anything else for it to appear. And then specifically characterized phenomena, and this is also going to come up a little bit later down in the text here, a specifically characterized phenomena, the definition is, it's a phenomena which is established by way of its own character without being merely imputed by a term or thought consciousness. And then, so these are the terms here. Any questions about any of these terms? So here, it's very interesting, is again for the Sautrantika's following reasoning. What is ultimate truth is what can actually do something, what can function. So actually, when we come later to talk about selflessness, selflessness is not ultimate truth, because selflessness is permanent. So selflessness is actually a conventional truth, because it can't perform a function. Whereas, of course, when we come next week in the Chittamatra Majjhimika, ultimate truth is how things exist. So there, of course, we talk about selflessness and emptiness and so forth. But remember here, in Vaibhashika Sautrantika, we're talking about two classes of phenomena in terms of ultimate truth, conventional truth. We're not talking about how things exist. So we need to keep that in mind in this context here. And so then conventional truth is a phenomena that is not able to perform a function ultimately. And so some synonyms for conventional truth is falsely existent, permanent phenomena, and generally characterized phenomena. And so generally characterized phenomena is opposite to specifically characterized phenomena. So specifically characterized phenomena, again, is a phenomena established by way of its own character from its own side, in other words, without being merely imputed by a term or thought consciousness. Whereas a generally characterized phenomena is a phenomena which is merely imputed by term or thought consciousness. So therefore, in terms of conventional truth, we have also what's called meaning generality or generic image. So to talk a little bit about this, we can go into this book here. Again, on page 55, he says the following about conventional truth, ultimate truth here for the Sautrantikas. He says, for Sautrantikas following reasoning, ultimate truths are things that are able to perform functions, particularly the function of acting as a cause. All things act as causes, if not of their own next moment, then of something else. For example, the last moment of a pot is the cause of its shards, and the last moment of a bolt of lightning is the cause of an illumination in the sky. For them, all impermanent phenomena are ultimate truths. Conventional truths are synonymous with permanent phenomena. Permanent generally means not changing moment by moment. So this refers to all phenomena that are mere negations or are mental images. So we're going to come up and look at what we talk about negative phenomena or negations. So a negation, a mere negation, is an absence, so it's a permanent phenomena, as are mental images. And this mental image is going to be very crucial in the section coming up when we talk about valid cognition and so forth. He says here, for example, space defined as a mere absence of obstructive contact is permanent, so are our mental constructs or generic images of things. These are involved in the process of thinking. When I see an apple, its aspect, is cast to my eye and I know it. But when I think apple, I have had to match the particular colour and shape in front of me with my pre-existing concept of apple, what Sautrantikas call a meaning generality. So a meaning generality is how we know things mentally in terms of concepts. You know, we see this cup here, but actually we're just seeing colours and shapes. But mentally we know that through that meaning generality. It's a concept of cup based on that configuration of colour and shape. We have such concepts or images for everything. We are capable of recognizing they are built out of our life experience. For instance, when I see an apple, I recognize it because of my previous experiences with many kinds of apples. I have a particular definition of apple that, consciously or not, I apply to the particular thing in front of me. For the Sautrantikas following reasoning, we are getting closer to the concerns that guide the Mahayana schools in their division of things into two truths. That is because what really matters to them is the kind of mind to which the two truths appear. Ultimate truths appear to direct perception. Direct perception is the ultimate type of consciousness because there is no mediation by generic image between the object and the consciousness that apprehends it. But thought about an object requires a mixing with generic images. Therefore, it lacks the purity and richness of direct perception and by comparison is not ultimate. Yeah. Correct. So, very good question. So that's why we really need to understand what permanent means. Of course, over time, as our life experiences change, our concepts about things will change. But what happens, of course, is we have a concept of it, and then it becomes a new concept. While we have that concept, it's not changing moment by moment. So even though over time our concepts change, they're not changing moment by moment. Because moment by moment means something created through causes and conditions. And a concept is not created by causes and conditions. It comes into existence based on our experiences. And this is the same idea like emptiness, which we're going to look at in the next weekend, is that these mental images come into existence, of course, based on changing phenomena. But the once that arises, then it's not changing moment by moment. But what will happen is that at some point that will be replaced by a slightly different concept based on more data that we've seen in our experiences. So therefore we need to understand, of course, that yes, over time our concepts change, but not in terms of being moment by moment changing, transient. Not produced through causes and conditions and disintegrating. They may come into existence, like a mental image, may last for a very short time, but during that time it's static. And it could be replaced by another image that's different. So it could appear that there's a changing thing, but actually it's something coming into existence, lasting a very short time, going out of existence, and replaced by something else in that sense. Okay. So then if we move on, it says here, another way of dividing existence is into negative phenomena and positive phenomena.
So here, what is a negative and positive phenomena? Negative phenomena is an object realized by an awareness apprehending it by way of eliminating its object of negation. A positive phenomenon is an object realized by an awareness apprehending it by way of not eliminating its object of negation. So a negative phenomenon is something that is through negating something else. And there are two types of negatives. To really understand what we mean by negative, let's look at the two types of negatives. There is a non-affirming negative and affirming negative. So a non-affirming negative is simply negating something. It's a mere negation. And examples of that are uncompounded space, true cessations, and emptiness. So uncompounded space here was defined as a lack of obstructive contact. So we are negating obstructive contact. That lack, that mere lack, is what's called a non-affirming negative, because when it's a mere negation, we're not affirming anything else. So as a result, that mere negation is permanent, unchanging. And another two examples here is true cessation. A true cessation was the separation from an object of negation through antidote. For example, a true cessation would be an absence of ignorance through applying wisdom. So that true cessation, that state, is a non-affirming negative. It's a mere negation of ignorance or mental affliction by the force of an antidote. It's very interesting here as an illustration, emptiness. Because actually in Sautrantika, normally we don't talk about emptiness. So it's very interesting here why in this tenets text, emptiness comes up. But again, we can use emptiness or selflessness in the same way here, that emptiness or selflessness is a mere negation of self or mere negation of truly existent person or object. So I haven't found anything what this emptiness refers to, because certainly this word emptiness here is not referring to a lack of inherent existence, because Sautrantika actually accept that. Sometimes we saw in the four seals on the first day, I think it was, that one mark of being a Buddhist in terms of our philosophical view was to accept that all phenomena are empty and selfless. And one way of understanding that is if we actually look at our chart, the coarse and subtle selflessness chart, we see that in the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, but also the following schools, they refute the person being empty of being permanent, unitary, independent, and self-sufficient, substantially existent. So they refute that. And so often in the four seals, when they talk about phenomena being empty and selfless, they match empty and selfless to those two things. So it's often said that Vaibhashika and Sautrantika accept that things are empty because they're empty of a unitary, permanent, independent self or the object of use of that. And then they refer selflessness to the second one. So that's, it could be maybe that what is the word emptiness here is referring to. Emptiness in terms of person being empty of being unitary, unchanging and independent. That's my speculation anyway, because I haven't seen anything what that word there is referring to. So these are examples of non-affirming negatives. They're simply a mere absence, whereas an affirming negative is that we're negating something, but through that negation, we are implying something else. We are affirming something else.
And sometimes in the texts that I studied earlier, it comes to mind now, is when they give an example of a affirming negative, it's something like fat Devadatta not eating during the day. So, of course, not eating during the day is a negation. He's not eating during the day. But the fact that he's fat is affirming that he must be eating at night. Anyway, so that's one that sometimes comes up in the text. But here we have two different affirming negatives. So the opposite of non-thing. So non-thing, of course, is negating thing. And the opposite of that is basically affirming thing. So that's an affirming negative. And similarly, the appearance of the opposite of non-pot to a conception of apprehending pot. The same thing is that non-pot is a negation, and the opposite of that is really affirming pot. So it's basically the appearance of pot to a conception apprehending pot. And I think maybe one of the reasons they gave that example here of the affirming negative is what's going to come a little bit later, called isolate. And it's really a lot to do with how we know things conceptually. What is the actual mechanism of knowing cup? And actually, conceptually, knowing cup is knowing the opposite of what's not a cup. That's actually the process. And we're going to look at that very shortly, because in this it talks about isolates a little bit later. And so I think this is why maybe the example here is given in that way. And then very briefly before we take a morning tea break, unless there's a question about this so far, the affirming, non-affirming? Okay. Then there's another way of dividing existence into singularities and pluralities. I can't even pronounce that. And again, here, it's a singular thing. The definition, actually, we've got the from the collected topics here, the definition of a singularity or a singular phenomena is a phenomena which is not diverse. And the definition of a plurality, or here it calls it a different phenomena, is phenomena which are diverse. So some examples, we can look at the examples here, but also they have examples in the collected topics. So there are two types of singularities, false singularities and true singularities. And I think here false and true are synonymous with then conventional truth, ultimate truth. The true singularity, of course, is then synonymous with ultimate truth or thing or impermanent phenomena, and false singularity is synonymous with conventional truth, permanent phenomena. So here we have object of knowledge and generally characterized phenomena as false singularities, and true singularities is thing and impermanent phenomena. Because remember, object of knowledge is synonymous with existent, and existent has both permanent and impermanent. So if something has both categories, then it's considered to be false because it has some false things within it, even though there are some true things within it. So that's why object of knowledge is false singularity. And then there are two types of pluralities. There's false and true. Example of false plurality is the pair isolate of pot and isolate of pillar. An example of a true pair is pot and pillar. So I want to talk about this word isolate here because it's very core to Sautrantika, particularly the ideas coming from Dharmakirti in terms of what we briefly saw before in terms of specifically characterized phenomena, generally characterized phenomena, and how we know things directly and then conceptually. So I want to look at that briefly then, but after the morning tea break, because I think we need a cup of tea or coffee to even try to get our head around this topic of isolates. So let's have a morning tea break first.